You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, April 17th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting live from the bowels of the Wynn Hotel in the exposition room of the 2015 Mass Torts Conference. Today on the program, Brian Burr, an attorney who sat on the BP Settlement Committee, also Cenk Uygur, host of the Young Turks, and Virginia Buchanan, an attorney who will speak to the dangers of energy drinks. It's a specifically my gift to Matt and Michael back in the, well, they're not in the studio. I have no idea where they are, frankly. For all I know, they're both sitting by the pool somewhere pretending that they're, listening to the show. Just occasionally sending me random IMs. Oh, sounds great. Today is the last day of coverage as I will be returning back to New York City later today. Okay, Matt just informs me that he's actually by the jacuzzi. So, excuse me. So just a word about who we're going to be talking to today. I pre-taped the interview with Virginia Buchanan, who is the attorney talking about the energy drinks. She doesn't have an active case, but she had the firm, I guess, is just provides resources on it. She's the head of medical negligence at Levin Papantonio. I guess I'm starting to realize that I believe all the attorneys that I spoke to this week were from Levin Papantonio, or was there one? So a little dominated by Levin Papantonio this trip. Each trip, I'm not sure who I'm going to end up talking to. It's sometimes a function of what attorneys have come to this event. Who I literally run into and talk to and find their cases interesting. And of course, I think we had spoken to Brian Barr, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, when the BP settlement, I guess that was 2 years ago when the BP settlement happened. And like I say, he is an attorney from Levin Papantonio, but sat on the negotiation committee. And we will ask him about that and also sort of check in on the Gulf after 5 years. Update, this is a fairly unique year for me insofar as I am not down. I am not down in terms of the in terms of the gambling. So I'm not crazy up, but I'm not down. And so there's a good chance I will not have to pretend like I didn't lose. money when I get home. And also, if I sound a little bit tired, it's not just because I stayed up a little bit too late last night, but the walls are paper thin here, apparently at the Wynn. For the second night in a row, I was provided with some free adult entertainment. But I don't think we need to go into that. Okay, I was going to play the stuff from the pre-tape of the attorney, but before we do that, actually, because I didn't realize how bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm not sure if I've got that right. Joining me now at the desk, the booth, the microphone is Cenk Uygur, the host of the Young Turks. Good morning, Cenk.
What's up, Sam? How you doing?
I'm doing great. Congratulations. Won the Clarence Darrow Award yesterday.
Thank you.
From the a bunch of tort lawyers gave it to you.
Yeah. As George Lopez kept saying last night, mass torts.
I didn't see George Lopez last night.
He was pretty good.
I got a little bit stuck at the tables. All right, so Cenk, a lot in the news today that we can talk about. I also wanted to talk to you about just sort of media in general, mm-hmm. and particularly as it pertains going into this election season. But literally, just in the past 2 days, the House voted to repeal the estate tax. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. I think that's going to be vetoed if it actually gets through the Senate, which it very well may. But more importantly, in terms of what is real, I should also say that Kansas now has just this sort of unbelievably punitive bill, which it literally is just the epitome and the definition of poor shaming. Saying that those on government assistance, there's a whole list of things that they're not allowed to spend their money at. But the irony is, of course, is they only take $25. There's a $25 daily limit on the ATM withdrawals using the debit cards used under the temporary assistance to needy families. And with a $25 minimum, you know what that means. It just means that each time they go to pull from the ATM, they get hit up with a bank fee, right?
Oh,
so the percentage of bank fees is higher. It's unbelievable. But where I want to start at is, and I will let you speak during this interview, is with the passage, or I should say not the passage, but the unveiling of a bill, which is essentially fast-track authority, which was done, it's a trade promotion authority, TPA they're calling it. It came out of a committee in the Senate with Wyden and Hatch agreeing on this. And it seems like a lot of other Democrats were surprised. This is sort of like, Wyden's good on some things, but he's done this before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Medicare and Paul Ryan. But give me your opinion, because you're not so confident that this is going to be stopped.
Yeah. I got a lot to say on Kansas and the estate tax too. Starting on this, first of all, no, we're not going to stop it. They're money rules, and so there's a ton of money at stake. All the corporations want this. They rule this country. It no way, no how it stopped. No way, no way, no way. You got Obama and the Republicans agreeing. There's no way it stopped, okay? And so, don't get me wrong, progressives, God bless your hearts, fight, and I'll be right there with you, and we'll fight to the bitter end, right? But secondly, I enjoy the irony of just having had the debate of, like, if you're going to make a peace deal, you better have Congress authorize it and reauthorize it every 90 days. We will not have peace on our watch, right?
Right, right.
Okay. Oh, you're going to give away national sovereignty. Let them, corporations, write our environmental laws, every other kind of law. Just give away our government in so many ways, governmental responsibilities. Yeah, you don't need authorization for that. Just fast track it.
Right. And people should understand that what the fast track does is it basically says you cannot obstruct this. So there's no filibuster or anything like that. No parliamentary procedure. You cannot amend this. It's an up or down vote. And you have to vote to have the up or down vote before you even see what it is you're going to be voting on. So, you know, for all they know, it could be like, here's a trade deal that says you believe that all human beings have rights. And also, we're going to do all this other stuff. So, you know, it could put you in a position where that vote could be rather tricky if you if it's just up or down.
The reason I like this story is because it shows you how monumentally full of crap Republicans are and the rest of the media is. Now, wait a minute. I thought you guys hated this Obama guy. I thought you would never agree to anything he wanted. I thought you were principally concerned about his executive actions.
Right.
That he had too much authority.
Right.
And now the entire Republican Party just agreed to have President Obama have almost unlimited authority in this deal, and in a deal that is monumentally important in terms of both sovereignty and just the sheer number of dollars that are involved, right? Oh, it turns out you guys were lying. It turns out that actually the Democrats and the Republicans work together, and you both work for corporations. That all the rest of it is just window dressing. Oh, executive authority this, and, you know, he's too powerful that. No, you didn't mean any of it. You just meant, oh, just give it away to the corporations like we want you to.
Well, you know what's amazing about this is that we are going to get into it. I mean, look, I don't know what's going to happen on the Democratic side, but I can tell you that you're already hearing from people like, obviously, you're going to hear from Sherrod Brown. You're going to hear from Elizabeth Warren. Chuck Schumer was like, this process is not good. Like, he's already coming out. It's first the step out of the gate.
I don't believe him.
Well.
And I'll tell you why. Because he wants to get Harry Reid's job. There's a decent number of progressives.
He already has Harry Reid's job. I mean, I think that if anything we're going to be talking about that's a done deal, he's got Harry Reid's job.
I hear you. But Schumer is going left in what I view to be a fairly disingenuous way. He has been doing it for over a year, right? And I don't believe him. I believe that he goes and says good things, and then when the chips are down and you need to reform Wall Street, there's no way he's going to be on your side.
No, I agree with that. But the question is he going to vote on this TPA? I mean, let me quote you. He said, now, to the extent that any of these fights are over with, him becoming the majority leader seems to be all but wrapped up, as far mm-hmm. as I can tell. But this is what his quote was in the Huffington Post yesterday. This process is not good. We're supposed to vote on the TPA. This is the essentially fast track. Tie our hands and not vote on amendments before we've seen what's in the TPP. I've never seen anything like it. Now, that could be he could be just setting up like, oh, you got to let us see the TPP, and then we'll just then I'll rubber stamp it. Who knows? But we could be looking at a scenario, and we probably are looking at a scenario either way, where the majority of the votes for this TPA, for the Fast Track Authority, is going to come from Republicans. And like you say,
absolutely.
I don't know of another issue that is more important that has gotten less news coverage than this trade deal. I mean, yep. I'm talking about, I mean, Ed Schultz, bless his heart, he's been talking about it on MSNBC, but nobody else. I mean, and I know that Hayes is inclined to do this, and maybe, you know, to be honest, I haven't watched that much MSNBC, but it does not seem like it's getting the relevance that it should. And the question is, will this story, now that there's a deal out there, will it actually get some play now?
Look, you know, my experience at MSNBC leads me to believe that this is the kind of thing that they're going to be very, very careful about, because you'd be defying the president. What kind of media do we have that gives a damn what the president thinks, right? But we do, and they're going to be really careful, because they're not going to want to call Obama a corporate shill, which he absolutely is. They'll never say that. You'll never hear them say that, right? Instead, they'll make some news, Sam, in about a week or so, when one of them, you know, tackles it, and they're like, whoa, look at this. They kind of tackled it a little bit. That's not enough. And you're proving that it's the exception and not the rule that you guys talk about this and explain what's really happening. President Obama's never disagreed with the Republicans when it came to corporate giveaways. Right. Never.
Right. It's interesting. I have a theory about it, and I wonder if it isn't just a function of, you know, look, Comcast is the majority owner of MSNBC right now, and Comcast really has one agenda, it seems to me, that overrides every other agenda, which is to get the biggest merger in the history of that industry approved. And there's three different executive agencies, essentially, that have to sign off on this. I have absolutely zero, less than zero percent of inside knowledge there. I couldn't know less about what goes on in that building, to be totally honest with you. But I suspect that is, at the very least, Comcast feels that way.
So, look, it's probably a macro issue. I don't think some Comcast executive comes and whispers in Lawrence O'Donnell's ear, right?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, I have no doubt that
we know that, right? But how does that macro issue work? How does it work in real life, right? So Comcast lets it be known to executives, hey, this is an important priority for us, the merger, Time Warner and Comcast, right? And you would have
I wouldn't even imagine they even have to do that.
That's right. I mean, you'd have to be the dumbest person in the building yes. to not realize what an important priority that is, right? And so executives have that rained down through management to the executive producer's ears. And that happens, okay? And so when a host goes to plan a segment or do an interview or whatever that they're doing, their executive producer might say things like, are you sure?
Right.
You know, like I mean, are we being unfair to President Obama? I mean, are you really sure about his intentions? They make things like that, like notes of caution.
Right.
There's lots of notes of caution, right? Because at some point, they're going to get pulled aside by middle-level management who whispers in their ear, and they're going to go, hey, what are you doing here, right? This is not a smart move.
Right.
It's all coded language like that. It's not heavily coded. You don't have to be a code breaker to figure it out, right? And so that's the incentives and disincentives that goes on in a system like that. And in this case, it's, you know, and over that, that's one aspect of it, the Comcast aspect that you mentioned. And then the second one is that, you know, MSNBC, rightly or wrongly, perceives themselves as Team Democrat. I know when I was there, they would say, hey, do we really want to speak out against the home team? And I always thought, I don't know who you're talking about when you say home team. Of course, I know who they're talking about.
right.
But that's not my home team.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, I don't know. I've always found that sort of somewhat, I guess, sort of surprising, but on some level. But
you know, I'll connect the two. See, I'll tell you a story that I almost never mention. At one point, I was doing an interview on MSNBC. It was with a progressive journalist, and I was saying that all the politicians are corrupt, or almost all, and I did this thing that was a little risky on air. I said, name three honest Democrats, right? And there are three honest Democrats in the country, right? And he went, Ed Markey. I was like, I'll give it to you. He said, Waxman. I said, I'll give it to you. And then he said, Schumer. And I was like, that's literally what the reaction I had. I burst out laughing. And I got a talking to after that. Just like I said, that chain happened, and then my EP came in and said, hey, Cenk, those guys are on our team. You don't have to say things like that.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. You know, it was funny, too, but I guess, you know, Schumer in particular. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, Michael just DM'd me to remind me that Schumer was also questioning recently, you know, should President Obama have exerted so much interest on Obamacare as opposed to, I guess, I don't know what really Schumer had in mind he should be doing, enforcing.
Yeah, that drove me crazy.
But all right, so let's turn a little bit to 2016 and another sort of posturing. We're seeing Hillary Clinton praise Elizabeth Warren.
We're seeing
there's some report today that she may hire Gary Gensler as her campaign CFO. Gary Gensler, who turned out to be the head of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, who turned out to be much better than people anticipated. Yep. Not just better than people anticipated, was good.
Yeah.
In terms of being a regulator of commodity trading. I mean,
so I'll get charges of unfairness here, right, with Hillary. But
Jake, let me just ask you this. I mean, do you really have to? I mean, we're all on the same team here.
We're all on the same team. You get it, right? So, first of all, if you say Hillary is better than the Republicans, with these Republicans, impossible to disagree with that. Of course she's better than the Republicans. The Republicans are loathsome.
Right.
But I mean, like, oh, who's better, you know? The masked man down the street or Newt Gingrich? The masked man down the street. Yeah, I get it. They're horrible people, right?
Right.
So if you're talking about a primary and you say she'll do, you know, she's progressive, like she cares about children, right? I agree with you. She cares about children. I guess she'll do, right? But it doesn't warm my heart over, and it doesn't win my vote, right? In terms of primaries, if you got a real progressive against Hillary Clinton, I'll take a real progressive. Every time.
Of course.
So one that hasn't served on the board of Walmart for all this time, one that hasn't taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from Goldman Sachs to tell them that they were misunderstood, one that hasn't supported the Iraq war, seems to, talked about how we should have gone into Syria with bombing earlier, we should have supported the rebels in Syria earlier, the rebels who kind of turned out to be ISIS, and she brags about that. I don't get that. And she'll claim, no, I didn't mean the ISIS rebels. I meant the other rebels. No, you would have gotten into a mess because your nature is to get into messes because you think war is the answer.
Right.
So, no, not very interested in Hillary Clinton. And, of course, she's posturing. I mean, look, she was already taking too many risks by being in bed with Goldman Sachs before the primaries began. Now she realizes that. In a smart political move, she's, smothering Elizabeth Warren with love and Gary Gensler. He worked at Goldman Sachs, but turned out that he was a great guy, and he was a real reformer, and he was a really good guy inside the government. Not no problems. I like Gary Gensler a lot, right? But he goes to CFO, a fairly meaningless role, and no policy.
Right.
You know, you're just going to handle the money. Can Gary handle the money fine and be progressive in his little corner as he runs the cash register? Sure he could.
Right.
You know, but that doesn't really matter.
Right. I mean, one doesn't know. Is this a head fake? I mean, you know, sometimes I would imagine we go back and look at the CFOs of most campaigns, they will end up in the administration in some fashion or another. But this again could be something of a head fake. I mean, from my perspective, I don't know and I don't care really what is in Hillary Clinton's heart any more than I know or care what's in Barack Obama's heart. I mean, and it is very much about who they surround themselves with at any given time and what political pressures they feel and how sensitive they are to those political pressures, right? And so, I have a very similar feeling about Hillary Clinton. I'm not going to say she doesn't care about children. She did support welfare reform in the mid-90s. And so it wasn't, I mean, you know, it didn't, if you're a poor kid, that's not going to help you out, the welfare reform, particularly when the economy falls apart and there's no jobs. That said, I mean, I think we're similarly situated in terms of our perspective on the election. But it is interesting to see, at least in my mind, the power that Elizabeth Warren has, if only to make Clinton, at the least, sort of posture in that direction, right? I mean, because
that's a great point.
We did not have such a sort of a gravitational force in the past. Now, it may be just posturing. It may be posturing that has to be backed up with actually some legitimate moves. But we don't know. But it's better than going the other direction. Let's put it that way, right?
Yeah. She tried going another direction in 2008 in a primary and it didn't work.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, so I guess time will tell. But all right, so let's talk a little bit just about the sort of the media broadly speaking, because
before we get to that, can we double back to Kansas and say state tax for just a sec?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, the estate tax, I mean, it's pretty ballsy. I guess Dana Milbank, of all people, wrote something like, I think it's sort of inappropriate. And not only do I think it's inappropriate, I actually think the exemption is too high. And this is Dana Milbank, right? I mean, this is the guy who's, I don't know, he's sort of, you know, again, who, you know, people signal at different times, you know, and he's like, I'm the son of a cabinet maker. Well, that's great. I mean, but now you tell us that? You know what I mean? It's like he may be putting his fingers up in the wind, too, as much as, you know, Sir Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, for that matter. But go ahead.
So on the estate tax, first of all, people think it's going to apply to them. Hey, understand two things. It does not apply to 99.8% of estates. Whether you have an estate is a different question, right? And you'll know if you're a couple, you can leave $10.3 million.
I think it's 5.4, isn't
it? It's per person. So your father or your mother can leave you 5.4. And combined, it's somewhere, I don't know if it's 10.8, 10.3, in that ballpark. For your parents can leave you tax-free. Now, it's actually one of the rare places where you can get something tax-free, right? And so, under this proposal, okay? And I want people to understand, they're not double-taxing Conrad Hilton. They're taxing Paris Hilton for the first time on that money.
Right.
Paris Hilton never made that money. She's getting that money passed on to her. This is the first time she gets it. First time you get any money, whether it's a paycheck that you're getting, you won the lottery, any time you get money for the first time, the government taxes you. So in this case, it's Paris Hilton already has an enormous advantage that she doesn't have to pay taxes on the first $10 million. And you're really going to leave your kids more than $10 million? Really? Really, if you're out there, you're not going to leave them more than $10 million. You're just doing the richest bidding.
I mean, I like to think that I will be leaving. I mean, a lot has to do with how well I do at the tables before I head back to New York today, I have to say. But yes, of course. I mean, and I think, you know, I mean, I think, at the very least, I know this audience is aware how absurd it is. And you're right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it. It rose in for 2015 to $5.43 million per person. Now, people should understand that after that first, if it's just one parent, it's 5.43. If it's two, it's probably 10.86.
Right.
After that, then you have to pay a 40% tax rate on that. But that's it. I mean, 40%. So that's not, you know, I mean, there's no, and there may be on top of that a state tax, depending on what state you live in. But, you know, when you start getting up at around like 11, 12, 13 million that you're getting, and instead of, you know, your parents die, and they are going to leave you $15 million, or they have $15 million left in their estate, that means that you get the first 10 tax-free, more or less, really actually the first 11, and then the other four, you're going to get half of that. So you're stuck with $13 million instead of, I guess, $15
million. Come on, man. Come on. And you know what it is?
It's tough. To get by on that, just that 13.
Yeah, especially when you didn't do anything to earn it.
It's
right. It's in essence winning the lottery.
Right.
It's like saying, why are you taxing me when I won the lottery? Because we tax income. That's what we do. That's how we fund the government. That's how we go to war, right? If you're a Republican, you love war. That's how we pay for it. And to that point, this is going to cost America $256 billion.
Right, because we're really talking about literally a half dozen families. And we know where this is coming. This estate tax, which was dubbed the death tax by the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz, essentially because literally half a dozen families got together, the Waltons, a couple others, and said, let's hire this dude and let's push this. Because for them, it's not just a question of $13 to $15 million. It really does make they could take a sizable bite. Like they could only leave their heirs, you know, something like, I don't know, $500 million as opposed to $1 billion. And that's
For them, for some of them, it really is, since they have, I think on average, something like $6 billion per Walton now. And that's after Sam Walton passed it down. Well, then you're talking about a billion here, a billion there. That's real money to them. But think about that, right?
I'm not too concerned about right? it.
But think about that, right? The Sam Walton's grandkids didn't do anything to set up Walmart, right? And they're like quibbling over, should I have $2 billion or $3 billion left to me? But and because they don't want to be taxed at all, to protect a couple of dozen families, we're going to cost the government a quarter of $1 trillion. Well, so, I mean, you want to talk about redistributing wealth. They're redistributing it to the top.
Well, no, I would say, actually, I mean, for me, the issue is less about what it's costing the government, because I'm not so... I am of the mind that the government could just print more money if it wants to, frankly, but that's a different discussion. But it is about who is about mobility. It is about wealth inequality. What's interesting, because obviously if you keep the money in the hands of a – you can shuttle that money and keep it. You're basically developing an aristocracy, a moneyed aristocracy. What's interesting is that the Congressional Black Caucus – is in favor of repealing the estate tax, as far as I know. And I know this and understand this because of a couple of years ago, I was on an episode of Hayes' weekend show with a guy named Peebles, I think it is. And I can't remember where he made his money, but I was having these arguments with him at the table. He was Obama's finance chair when he was running in 2008. And I was having these arguments. I had no idea who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were arguing about the estate tax at the time. We were arguing about, I can't remember what it was, Medicare. And after the show, I was just like, and during the break, he's telling me, like, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus supports getting rid of the estate tax. And I'm like,
who cares?
Well, I don't care, A, but B. And he's like, because it's about building wealth in the Black community.
What a joke.
And that is the argument that essentially, oh, it also turns out, I should say, he's like the 9th richest African American in the country.
Oh, really? Just, I wouldn't have seen that coming. Oh, wow.
Coincidentally, he was in Forbes' top 10 African American wealth. But it's what he's talking about, you know, maintaining and building African American wealth in this country. He's really talking about his family is going to be the representative of African American wealth.
Of course. If
like he's just going to give it to all his cousins. Like we're going to give the money to very, very distant cousins.
So here's what I would be in favor of. I would take the entire estate tax and promise it in free education to whoever we thought qualified, higher education. Right? That's, I mean, what a great bridge, right? Bridge to of opportunity. So, hey, Sam Walton, thanks for working really hard. You made a gazillion dollars. You never had to worry about money your entire life. Your kids are now actually so rich. His 6 kids, I think, have more money than 100 million Americans combined. Okay, they're fine. That your grandkids are going to be fine. Their great grandkids are going to be fine. Well, they're probably going to be drug addicts, but that's okay. Anyway, so now can we tax some of that money to create the next Sam Waltons, right? To provide an opportunity. Let's take the money and say, hey, you get to keep an overwhelming percentage of it, but let's take some percentage and build opportunity for the next generation. It's a hard thing to argue against. I mean, Republicans would do it anyway. The guys who said, oh, budget, 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 and then just blew a quarter of a $1 trillion hole in the budget to help a dozen families to redistribute money to the top.
Right.
Right? But it'll make that argument harder.
Well, that's very un-American of you, Cenk. And speaking of being un-American, let's talk about Sam Brownback. A bill was passed by the Kansas legislature in, maybe 3 weeks ago. And Brownback has now, apparently, yesterday, signed it. I mentioned this at the top of the show. It bars spending temporary assistance to needy family funds on movies at swimming pools. Not to purchase a swimming pool, because obviously you can't buy a swimming pool, but to go to a swimming pool, like a community swimming pool or a private. I mean, just contemplate this for a minute. Like, if you're on welfare and you're a kid and it's the middle of the summer, you can't go to a swimming pool if it costs money. I mean, just contemplate, like, the stigma that just like, I mean, you can't, or on cruise ships, because we know there's so much money you get from Tampa. You're going on cruise ships. You can't do it at a jewelry store or a tattoo parlor or a massage parlor, body piercing parlor, psychic or fortune telling business, bail bond company, video arcade, or any retail establishment which provides adult oriented entertainment in which performers disrobe or perform in unclothed state. Like I said, it also does that $25 limit on withdrawals, which means that the percentage of your money that's going to be taken by fees is going to be higher, right? You're going to have to go every day to get $25, and you're going to pay a fee every day, as opposed to I'll take $50 out and be subject to the same $2.50 fee instead of $5 over the course of 2 days. I mean, just for example. Unbelievable.
Their disingenuous tricks have no bounds, right? So honestly, Sam, I didn't even think about that. I think that's a great point you're making. It's like with the drug testing. They pretend, oh, like, oh, these guys got a drug test. We know it's wildly ineffective. It's a tiny, tiny percentage of people.
Less than the general population, yes.
Yeah, than the general population. But it turns out the reality is, no, they have friends who are in the drug testing business, and it's all about funneling them money, right?
Well, it's a twofer. It's a twofer. It sets that narrative that, look, these people are, we're going to shame you. We're also going to imply that you're all drug addicts. You know, from Brownback, whose entire economic program in Kansas has been an unmitigated disaster. I mean, just a disaster. They brought in Arthur Laffer of the Laffer Curve fame. They cut taxes dramatically. Their job growth has been anemic, if not negative. Their budgets have been in incredibly bad shape. They've had to cut all sorts of services there. And this is a great way of saying, like, you know, really, the problem is the poor people.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the two that you pointed out, Sam, are the ones that really struck me. Cruise ships, they're in Kansas. Where are they spending the money on cruise ships?
That's all part of the narrative, right? It's like, you know, we're going to prevent people from Oh, you mean the poor people have been going on cruise ships? I can't afford to go on a cruise ship. Why should they be able to take their... No, of course that's not happening. Right?
Where are they finding a cruise ship in the middle of Kansas? Where are they finding that?
Well, they're flying what,
they're
to
flying
California.
To California, Miami?
That's right.
With their $25 to take a cruise ship?
That's right.
And the pools really, really struck me because it's ugly. It's not really just the stigma you're talking about, Sam, but it reminded me of no blacks allowed in the pools.
Right.
Now we've changed it, and it really is symbolic of what's happened in this country. No poor allowed, right? The new stratification is poor versus the middle class, because they desperately want to divert the middle class's attention away from who actually runs this country and who's actually creating the problems. So their whole point is hate the poor, hate the poor. Don't allow them. You can allow their kids to swim next to your kids. Don't, whatever you do, don't look at the rich. Don't look at the elite. Don't look at the special interests and the lobbyists that are actually running the country.
Well, and I also think that there is, I think it's a fairly safe assumption that for a lot of people, there is an association. When they talk about welfare recipients, there is a certain amount of coding that's going on there and saying, you know, we're talking about black people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think there's, I think it's both sort of metaphorically what you're talking about and literally from their perspective in the way that they deal with it. But it's just, man. And he's a big Christian too, isn't he?
yeah.
Isn't Sam
course.
Brownback like
of
the biggest
course.
Of Christians?
Yeah. Oh, he's big time Catholic. Might be Opus Dei. Yeah.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. And well, all these guys is so Christian that they love to beat up on the poor. They've never read the Bible. Everything is a lie. Every single thing that they say is a lie. If Jesus came back, he'd make a beeline for Kansas, grabs Sam Brownback by the ear and tosses his ass out on a cruise ship.
That's right. It would be pretty funny, actually, if Jesus came back and all he did really was just to run a cruise lines.
It would also be funny if Jesus came back and he was pissed and he's like, he just beats down one Republican after another. And they're like, watch out for the apostles. It's like a new gang.
What are you guys doing? All right, so let's talk just and I'll let you go because I know that we're both sort of in recovery mode a little bit from last night. We had a late dinner.
We did. And I was bragging last night that I don't get hangovers. Turns out I was slightly wrong about that.
Just give us a sense of like where you guys are at now, because you guys are growing. I mean, there's give me your sort of I know you spent a lot of time thinking about this, but what's the media going to look like in 5 years?
Yeah. You know, I have a good sense of 5 years. I have a much better sense of 25 years, right? In 25 years, TV as we know it today will not exist. It most definitely will not exist, okay? So now let me be clear about what I mean by that. So you will still have that box in your living room that looks really nice,
well,
the flat
actually,
screen.
Yeah, it's not even a box anymore, is it, really? I mean, it's more just like a sheet of glass.
Yeah, it's just a sheet. It's a screen. That's all it is, right? Now, you'll also have many other screens like you do today. You know, you'll have your iPad-like device. You'll have your iPhone-like device. And you'll have a number of screens that vary in size. And that'll just be seen as the largest screen you have.
Right.
And it will carry content, as it does now, but it'll be structured differently. So it'll be some that you pay for, some that you don't pay for. But what won't exist is the current channels. So, like, CBS doesn't mean anything. See, CBS is not a brand. Like, 60 Minutes is a brand. CBS is not a brand. Why would anybody go to watch something on CBS? Who in the new generation thinks, like, oh, man, whatever CBS is putting on, I'm watching. Right? That's not a thing that happens anymore, let alone 25 years from now.
That's interesting. So you don't think there's going to be any aggregation? I mean, isn't that really just sort of like...
It'll get re-aggregated. It'll break apart and re-aggregate.
There'll be like Hulu's as opposed to CBS Live. What about, like, let's say HBO Now?
They'll definitely be around. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but aren't they
basically like a CBS?
They are. So here's how it breaks apart and comes back together. So first of all, your cable bundle is preposterous.
Right. Well, that's basically, I think that's 5 years.
Yeah, that's on a death watch, right? They can't keep charging you $100 to $200 for a cable bundle when you don't watch 90% of the channels.
Right. What they'll do is you'll pay a la carte, and then they'll slowly creep up just the cost of your internet. So you're going to be paying $150 for your internet, and then you're going to have 12 other apps, essentially, that you buy that are a la carte. And that's
right.
The way they achieve it.
And then eventually, they'll... After all that splinters apart, that'll wipe out, I don't know, at least 60% of the channels that exist today, right? They won't be able to sustain themselves. They'll become niches where if you pay to be a member of the Golf Channel, then you'll get the Golf Channel, and it'll be more limited content because then they can't afford to produce that much programming because they've lost the subscriber fees, right?
Right.
So you'll wash away a ton of channels. They'll just disintegrate, right? And then at some point, there'll be new aggregations. The new channels will come together, right? But those channels will make sense. For sports fans, you'll have a sports channel maybe that competes with ESPN. ESPN will likely stick around because they're gigantic, right? The knitting channel, that'll exist in some platform that you pay for, right? Because they won't make enough money from advertising and have a broad enough audience. And that's going to be your spectrum from the ones that are enormous.
Where in all this is there news? I mean, where is there news in this? I mean, is there a news brand that continues? I mean...
Yeah, so obviously I'm enormously biased, but I really think, and our plan is, for that to be the Young Turks, for it to be the TYT network. So right now we're in negotiations with a lot of the TV companies. By TV companies, I mean literally the guys who make the screens, right? They're going to decide what apps go in.
Preloaded, right?
And they're going to decide what order they go in and how they're presented, right? And we're in negotiations with them to be the news company, right? Because we didn't start those negotiations, they did. You know why? Because they did market research. And they do market research and they go, okay, what's the largest online news network? It's indisputably the Young Turks. So they go, okay, let's make a deal, right? Now, okay, so that's the current state of affairs. Why do I think we're going to be the company into the future? Because we got that audience by doing the right things, and we're going to continue to do the right things, and the old guys aren't doing the right things. So when we talk honestly to the audience, and we don't put our corporate, you know, bosses ahead of our audience. We don't put access in front of our audience. I mean, Chuck Todd had a great moment where he accidentally slipped up on Meet the Press when he was talking to a bunch of comedians and told Lewis Black, well, if I was honest with the about with the politicians, they'd never come back on the show.
Right.
Right? And so that's a losing strategy. And they cannot compete with us if their idea of serving the audience is sucking up the politicians. We're going to slaughter them, right? So this is the model, right? Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be some sources, or probably one source, whose main job is to try to remain as objective as possible, right? Because we do commentary, we do analysis, so we don't mind having a perspective. And 9 out of 10 times, passionate will beat dispassionate. And we're passionate, right? But it doesn't mean that there's no room for dispassionate. But there is no room for neutrality. That's a big, big right. difference that a lot of people don't understand.
It's going to be interesting, you know, if politicians will ultimately figure out, like, they don't really need to go. I mean, from an electoral standpoint, this thing where Clinton goes in the van is rather brilliant, because she basically avoids the national media. But she still, well, let me put it this way. She avoids the national media, but for on her terms. So they put out a tweet. There's a video of her in a Chipotle. She shows up at where, you know, someone's house after the fact or whatever it was. Everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have prevented the national media from getting the jump on it and getting into a position where they actually are scrutinizing her. It's an interesting, I mean, I don't think it's a product. I don't know that, frankly, either way is terribly productive for American politics,
mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting change and tactic on her part that I think is going to be effective in terms of what they want to achieve. But yes, Chuck Todd complains like they'd never come on. And frankly, you know, but at one point I think they're going to say, like, there's no value in us going on. And I'm not sure for the rest of the American public, based upon watching Chuck Todd do that, whether or not there's a value. I mean, he's right, though. If he was challenging to them, they would not come on. Eventually, they would stop coming on. And they would go somewhere else where it's a little bit less hostile to them.
Well, I know literally, because somebody from Harry Reid's office a long time ago pulled me aside and said, Cenk, you're done. We're not letting Harry Reid back on your show. You're banned. I laughed and laughed. I was like, whoa, wow, Harry Reid won't come on the show anymore to give me his talking points.
That's the thing that I think, you know, it's interesting to me. It's like I've never, as a programmatically, I mean, I don't really talk to politicians that often. If I'm at like an event sort of like this and they're here, I'll ask them some questions and sit down. But I don't really, generally expect to get answers that are, you know, terribly surprising or interesting. And, you know, there's some politicians who I enjoy talking with because I actually think they're thoughtful. And
yep.
I want to know what their strategy is to do certain things. But in the main, I don't feel like, God, I'm not listening to Sam Cedar's show anymore because he hasn't had, you know, Harry Reid on in ages or something to that effect.
Yeah.
It's not as much of a detriment as they perceive it.
Right. So you're right on both counts. One, Chuck Todd can't lose access to those guys, and he will lose access to those guys if he's doing Meet the Press. That's the way the game is played right now. So that's why Meet the Press is falling in the ratings and will continue to fall and will never rise again, because it provides nothing interesting, right? And then you're also right that the politicians realize, hey, wait a minute, I can just put this video up on YouTube and I don't have to deal with a tiny hassle of like softball questions that I know are coming.
I can totally dictate the message, and then what's going to happen is they're going to run it on the on Meet the Press anyways.
That's right.
It's just going to be my YouTube, and they're going to talk about it. And I talk about message discipline. I can stay right on message because I can do a take two.
That's all exactly right. Eventually, out of that, someone will rise that is actually has enough ratings and is respected enough that politicians will have to go on there to try to compete, right? Because, so, for example, it actually already exists on the right. And honestly, it's Fox News. So there's going to be about a dozen Republicans and fighting to the death in that primary, right?
Right.
And they got to stand out, right? And Fox News has a conservative audience. And Megyn Kelly and from time to time Bill O'Reilly will actually ask them challenging questions.
Yep.
You know, 79% of the interview will be softballs. But for, you know, for some percentage of the interview, Megyn Kelly and Bill O'Reilly will ask them questions that make them uncomfortable, right? And so that's because they've accrued enough power and ratings to be able to do that. But on a national level...
And Roger Ailes has presumably said, like, yeah, you got the green light on this one.
Right. Now, they're not going to do it once that person is in power.
Right.
But in order to determine who's going to be in power, they're going to have that process.
Right.
On a bipartisan manner, from the guys who should be doing it to both Democrats and Republicans, that no longer exists.
Yeah. Well, Cenk Uygur, pleasure to see you. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you, Sam.
And as always, good luck with what's going on. And obviously, I think full disclosure, people know that our YouTube channel is part of the TYT extended network.
Yep.
Are we going to be on one of those flat screens? Or what's happening?
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
I don't know. You tell me.
To be determined, but I'll get back to you on that.
This is the way I negotiate, folks. I bring them right on. And just
what kind of an ambush interview is this? Are you asking me gotcha questions? Like, when you think what newspaper you read is a gotcha question, you might have got yourself, but yeah.
Indeed. Cenk Uygur, always a pleasure. Thanks. Right. We're going to take a quick break, folks. When we come back, Brian Barr is going to be with us in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. I am in the bowels of the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas at the 2015 Mass Torts Conference. Joining me now and welcoming him back to the program, Brian Barr. You are an attorney at Levin Papantonio. Oh, I'm sorry. Hold on one second. Let's try that again. You are an attorney at Levin Papantonio.
Yep.
And you sat on, or still sit, I guess, on the plaintiff steering committee of the BP agreement. I remember 2 years ago, I think we were down at the other end of this. I don't know if it was 2 years this month or in October.
Yeah, it was in June.
It was in June.
No, April. April when we got the agreement in principle.
And I think on that day, you came by and talked to us about it to the extent that you could. So we're 5 years out from the spill. What's going on from the plaintiff's steering committee perspective?
I mean, from our perspective, you know, a lot of the litigation is concluded. We've tried the Phase 1 case and the Phase 2 case. The court in Phase 1 found that BP committed reckless conduct. They were grossly negligent in causing the rig to explode. In Phase 2, you know, he determined the amount of barrels that came out of the well. And then in Phase 3, he's trying the conduct of the defendants as far as the Civil Clean Water Act penalties. So that's largely done. We've taken all the depositions, reviewed all the documents, and put that case on trial. BP's appealing those rulings up to the Fifth Circuit. On the settlement side, You know, we did the class settlement that was entered by the court. And then at some point in time, BP had a change of heart and started trying to get out of a settlement that they negotiated for 2 years with us and fought us all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Supreme Court finally turned them down. So we're hoping that the settlement process really gets rolling now and we really get payments out to people.
So people have yet to be – now, so if I remember correctly, the way the settlement process goes is you are entitled to a certain amount depending on what concentric circle you are from sort of like the physical proximity to the coast, and then also a formula based upon what – how much of your living –
yeah, you got a good memory.
Is a function of the of you know, if you're a shrimper, there's a calculation there.
Right.
As well.
Yeah. What we did is we took the Gulf South. The class settlement includes all of Mississippi, all of Alabama, all of Louisiana, four counties in Texas, and then the entire Gulf Coast of Florida. So the entire Panhandle, and then the Gulf Coast going down to the Keys. And then we broke that out into zones A, B, C, and D. Where you are in the zones depends upon which – determines which tests are applied to you and then the compensation multipliers you get. And then we have formulas that determine whether or not your loss was caused by the spill.
Now, does BP basically get involved in sort of like reneging a little bit on the settlement and then going through this process again? Are they basically just trying to amortize it? I mean, it's like a twofer for them. Like, if we can get it reduced, that's great. But if we don't, time also reduces it in some way.
I think there's multiple things going on there. I think the lawyers are worried about what they represented to their client at the time we did the settlement. They came out and said the settlement, was they thought was worth like $7.8 billion. We told them at the time that we thought that was wildly wrong. And we thought it was substantially higher than that. And then as claims started getting processed, they started upping their estimates. And then I think they became concerned that this settlement was in the $15 to $20 billion range.
So in other words, you settled on the formula. They just presumed the inputs to that formula were less than they were.
Yes.
And because, I mean, I guess on some level, at least their denial of what damage they did to the area, well, it seems like it was sincere, right?
They very consistently believe they didn't cause any harm. You know, this is a company, you know, I just don't think they're ever going to get it. They like to say the right things and do nothing.
I've seen the commercials.
Yeah.
They really do care. And apparently the other day, right, weren't they admonished the other day for basically coming out and saying, hey, we're done. I mean, the Gulf is back.
Yeah, they came out and they said, look, we've done all these studies. The Gulf is healthy. It's recovering. All these species we thought were destroyed are rebounding. All of these, you know, alarmists are just completely wrong. And then all of the people doing the studies as part of what's called the NERDA process, the
National Resource Damage Assessment,
came out and said, what are you talking about? That's not what these studies show at all. And we're not far enough out. I mean, they cause such...
Now, we should say, I just want to make this clear to people. Like, we're not talking euphemistically here. On March 16th, they came out and they said, the Gulf is rebounding. And that day, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment process basically said, what? You're insane.
Their talking head that they use all the time, the guy's name's Jeff Morrell. He's the vice president of communications. And I guess the guy just doesn't have a conscience with what he's going to say. Went on CNN and was just saying the Gulf is doing great. It's doing great. All of the data shows it's doing great. And just pretending like none of this happened. Meanwhile, you walk around in the marshes of Louisiana, there's still oil there. It's still, there's an island called Cat Island. Has almost completely disappeared. At the time of the spill, it was a huge nesting island for birds. Now it's a little spit of land, not much bigger than this table we're sitting at. No trees on it at all, no birds.
It and just killed these every part of the ecosystem so that it literally disintegrated.
They're acting like nothing happened. And, you know, the reality is it takes a long time to determine what the ultimate impacts of this are going to be. We won't know for decades. And it's just the height of, I mean, it just disgusts me to listen to B come out and try and pretend like they didn't do any harm here.
And frankly, I mean, the sad part about this is it's effective. Because I heard the BP, you know, I don't know if I saw it on some ad somewhere. You know, it's sort of like in the back of my mind. Like, it's over. We've rebounded. And I, you know, in the back of my mind, I was just like, oh, well, that's good.
What I've learned throughout this entire case is if you have an unlimited pocketbook for a PR budget and no conscience, you can convince the American public of anything.
I think there's a lot of people who have figured that out.
And, well, I mean, I would just – it's the no conscience thing that really bugs me because when we have –
I should tell people, too, that sitting across from you, there are visual cues that you're not articulating. You're being circumspect.
I'm trying to tone it down a little
yes,
bit.
Yes, no, I know. I'm just trying to make that clear I imagine that, you know, you're not necessarily still being on that plane of steering committee. You can't necessarily express things in the way that you might want.
Think about it. For the past 2 years, they have run ads, not just in the Gulf, but throughout the country, calling claimants whose businesses and lives they disrupted and caused great harm to. They've called them frauds. They've talked about all these criminal prosecutions. What they haven't told people is that all of these frauds they're talking about came out of their process, the GCCF. Very few of them came out of the class settlement. Are there some fraudulent claims there? I'm sure there are.
Of course.
But there are 300,000 claims on file. They can't point to that many. This isn't some prevalent process with the claims program. Yet they point to, they say, oh, you know, all these people were prosecuted. Yeah, on the system you were doing, not ours.
Right.
And that's what's a fraud. And, you know, what all they're trying to do is convince people not to file a claim that they're entitled to do. And it's sad to me to sit there and watch that.
So, I mean, I'm just looking at some of the data. Dolphins still sick and dying. 43 died just last month. Nearly 1,200 dolphins have been found dead. Another 75 too sick to swim. This is since the BP blowout. Brown pelicans. 12 to 15% of the population wiped out. Ants are barely even, like, I guess, returning to the grass in the coastal region. It goes on and on. Give me a sense of, and apparently, what's also interesting is that the number of incidents where people have been injured or there has been hazardous incidents is down, but on a per capita basis, it's up. In other words, there's less rigs apparently there than there were back in 2009, but there are more fatalities and hazardous incidents per rig, which is disturbing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know because it doesn't suggest that they have really sort of internalize this notion of we've got to be a little bit more safe than.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I would say on that is, I mean, I believed prior to this case, I had a big belief that offshore drilling was just this inherently dangerous thing. I think what I've learned is if you do it right, it can be done safely. Now, that doesn't say I support it all over the place. I mean, there are issues, but you have to do it right. And you get a company like BP that takes every shortcut they can possibly take. Next thing you know, you blow up the rig and you got oil spewing into the Gulf for 87 days. What shocked me about this whole thing, they never had a plan on how to deal with this. They never, I can't say they never thought about it. There were documents that showed that they were aware there was something like this could happen going back to at least the early 90s. And those documents told them the exact things they would have to do. But BP never spent a single penny even looking at how would I stop something like this. Their whole plan was to think about it once it happened. That was their plan. And it's mind-boggling.
Is that, and you know, I asked this question, I think, of your colleague yesterday. I have yet to play the interview. But is that just simply a calculation, like we could spend X number of dollars today to plan for what we're going to do if this thing happens. But in the that may open us up to some question of liability because we anticipated it, which suggests that in some level we knew that it could happen. That may make us more liable. Or at the end of the day, we're going to end up paying out the same amount of money, so we might as well not spend that money now. I mean, what is the calculation that they make, or is it just sheer incompetence?
I actually lean towards more incompetence or just lack of care. It would not have been that expensive for them to research this. I mean, building a capping stack, I think, cost them $40, $50 million. They've now got one on reserve. They know how to use it. They've built it now. But in the grand scheme of things, yeah, that sounds like a lot of money. But this type of event doesn't happen that often. But they certainly, I mean, everybody in the industry would have told you, we knew something like this could happen. We didn't believe it would. And that leads into a whole other different discussion. But how you operate in an atmosphere like that, I mean, they described it as operating in space. That's how they described it. So when you operate in an atmosphere like that, how you don't have a plan on what to do when this happens, it's mind-boggling.
So, I mean, what are the chances that something like this could happen again?
I think if BP's running rigs out there, the chance is pretty good because I doubt they've learned anything.
And what about other, what could be done, I guess, more broadly speaking, to deal with this? I mean, is it really... do we have to say that there are, I mean, do we need more statutory, I guess, authority and regulation? I mean, I know there's been some things where they've divided some agencies so that they're more effective, but right. What else needs to be done at this point?
We need a regulatory agency that's not captured by the industry.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you get these guys, they all know that once I leave this agency, my next job is with an oil company. They don't, our government does not do a good job of monitoring what they're doing. Now, I think they are trying to do better, given the spill. But prior to the explosion, there was very little. I mean, it was, you know, the sad thing is, you know, I talked all about their plan. The government approved their lack of a plan.
Right.
I mean, so, you know, you had a completely captive agency that just signed off on whatever they want to do. I think that's changing, and that has to happen. That, to me, is the biggest thing that we can do to try and prevent something like this from happening again. But at the end of the day, I mean, you just have to have companies that are willing, that understand the importance of all of these different regulations that are in place. Because BP violated a ton of regulations in the way they drilled this rig as well.
And did the regulatory agencies lack the authority or just sort of the resources to...
I'd say resources and knowledge. Because there's some things they don't know about what they're doing. And, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes that was made with BP is decisions were made on a one-off basis. So BP would send in a request and say, we want to have this deviation to our plan. And the regulators would say, okay. But then they never lined them all up and
right.
say, here's
so
all the deviations they've done.
Holistically,
right.
You're just looking and you don't realize, like, you can get away with one of these deviations, but this pattern of deviations takes you far further afield than where you should be.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and so what is next on the horizon? It's just this whether the settlement will go through?
Well, the settlement's going through. The Supreme Court finally told BP to go away. They're not taking their appeal. So the settlement is now final. There's a June 8th filing deadline for anybody that's going to file a claim. They have to file by June 8th. The MDL on the litigation side, we've got what we are calling...
The MDL.
The multi-district litigation
okay.
Where we're litigating the case in the Eastern District of Louisiana. We've got some OPA test cases coming up where we are testing some of the causation theories of the Oil Pollution Act to help instruct pending cases because not every case settled as part of the class settlement. For example, you know, there were, you know, banks were excluded. All your local and state governments were excluded. So we've got to answer some.
Wait a second. So local and state governments have not been made whole? I mean, I imagine that local and state governments expended a huge amount of money.
I think what BP has done, I think they've reimbursed some of that money for some of them, but the state of Alabama is going to trial this year.
Is sort of the classic case of just sort of like the taxpayer now picking up the bill, right?
They're a recidivist. This is what they do in every case. They do it every time. And it's not, none of this is surprising to us that know this company. And that's, you know,
what is it that makes it like a corporate? I mean, why is it that there are some companies? I mean, obviously, but you know, when you get this large, you would imagine like it's not like the personality of, you know. I mean, I understand like, hey, I don't go to that bakery because the guy who owns it's a jerk and he only hires jerks. And but when you get a company this big, like, what creates that corporate culture? As opposed to, I don't know, an oil company that isn't as bad as BP. I mean,
that's a hard question to answer. I guess what I would say is once you get as large as they are, you feel like you're above the law and you can do whatever you want to do. And if you screw up, which they do frequently, it's not going to.
Is it because it's so large? There's so little personal accountability that. This sort of like personal, this lack of sense of like personal accountability aggregates, and there's just sort of this broader sense of like, not on me.
That, and if they really mess up, I mean, look, this spill right now has cost BP somewhere in the $40 to $50 billion range. It's going to be substantially more than that by the time it's over, because they're facing a potentially $13 billion fine from the federal government. But it's not going to bankrupt them. I mean, they're too big. So, I mean, I think one of the things that would get their attention, when you were saying, what can we do to change the way they act, if our government would grow a spine and quit dealing with repeat felons like BP, quit letting them enter contracts with the United States, I think that'd fix it.
And what about criminal liability for their executives?
As far as I can tell, that's not going anywhere. The company was held criminally liable. And then they pressed charges against a couple of the guys on the rigs, which to me that was, I mean, those guys messed up. There's no question. But they have to live with the decisions they made when they killed 11 of their friends and injured so many people. And I mean, they have to live with that. But they were just following the policies of the larger, you know, the corporate executives. And those are the people that should be prosecuted. But, you know, Tony Hayward appears to have his life back.
On. It was very difficult for him at one point. I know that
those yacht rides are tough.
He could, yeah. I mean, I think for a long time he couldn't get on that yacht. I mean, weeks, I think, at a time, right? I mean, And that's very difficult.
I feel for the guy.
I can tell you, yeah. If you're used to being on the water in your yacht and you don't have the opportunity to go for a certain period of time, that can really weigh on you.
It's very upsetting.
Brian Barr, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam, for having me.
Updating us, and I guess, you know, maybe in 2 years we will check in again, and hopefully the story will be slightly different, at least in terms of restitution for a lot of the people in the Gulf. But I have a feeling from an environmental standpoint, it could theoretically be worse in terms of what our knowledge is of the damage that was done. All right, really appreciate your time.
Yep, thanks.
Folks, now I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to play part of the interview with Virginia Buchanan, just because yesterday we played. And I should also say I got a tweet about yesterday's interview regarding the arsenic in the wine. And the tweet was from longtime listener who directed me to a Snopes piece on this. And the Snopes piece on the arsenic in the wine basically said unproven, which I think was the way that it was more or less characterized on the program, at least in terms of how unhealthy the wine is. And I just want to reiterate that there are levels that the U.S. government says is legitimate for arsenic in our water supply. And there is a calculation that the EPA makes that presuming a certain amount of water intake. And one of the things about arsenic is that it accumulates in the body. The argument is that if you have, the calculation should not just be that there's arsenic in the wine, it should be you multiply that level times the amount that is presumed to be consumed by people. And I thought that was made pretty clear by the attorney yesterday, and that he also stated they were going to be doing more testing, independent testing. And there is a question of how this arsenic gets into the wine, whether or not it's put in as a preservative or if it's a sort of naturally occurring or is a simply a function of the intake by the grape because perhaps there was contamination in the soil. So I just wanted to, you know, to make that clear. I thought it was pretty clear in the interview yesterday, but maybe not. Meanwhile, here is, just for balance, because, you know, I didn't want to ruin just Michael's day yesterday, I also want to now try and change Matt's behavior a little bit. Oh, excuse me. With these energy drinks. And again, this is another situation where it's like the drinking one energy drink is not necessarily bad for you. But it's wildly unregulated and it can be dangerous, particularly for kids, or if you drink excessive amounts of it, Matt. So here's that interview with Virginia Buchanan from yesterday. What's going on? Hold on 1 second. Bear with me, folks. I didn't have it plugged in. A Torts Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. Joining me now is Virginia Buchanan. You are from Levin Papantonio, correct?
I am. I head the medical negligence department there and do products work as well.
All right. One product I have to talk to you about, because my understanding is that you have you've done some work on this and you're at least, at the very least, aware of it. Just to be fair to one of my producers back in New York, Michael, yesterday we talked about the potential that there is some cheaper wines that may contain higher than appropriate levels of arsenic. My understanding is you've done some work on the energy drinks.
Right, and actually my history goes way back because I had one of the first cases against a natural food supplement containing ephedra, resulting in a death of Peach Schlendorf in New York, and it was a cutting-edge case and really brought to light the problems with people using what they call natural ingredients in consumer products and with devastating impact. So then in 2011, when we started seeing really mass reports about these energy drinks, energy because they contain high amounts of caffeine. Most of them contain a minimum of 250 plus of caffeine, and at 600 milligrams, we're really at risk for caffeine intoxication. And so that led to a number of private lawsuits because teens and adolescents were being targeted. We're having
I mean, all this stuff is marketed towards, like, teens, right?
It is. Isn't it? I mean, they use all of this adrenaline rush, the Red Bull, the powerful. They call some of the drinks cocaine. So it's really meant to fuel that high energy, the things that young people would seek, to stay up and study, to go out and party, all of that. So it really poses a health risk. And so we have been watching that, monitoring that from within the firm, talking about it, doing the research, and just aiding in any of the support efforts for people involved in that litigation.
So what, I mean, like, you know, what's the theory there? Is that, I mean, you know, people buy these drinks, they want energy, it gives them energy, you know. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that if you have too much energy, it could be bad for you, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I think people really don't realize it because the marketing on behalf of these companies is so sophisticated, and it sounds like it is without any type of peril associated with it. But the myocardium, the heart, is particularly susceptible to the effects of heavy doses of any stimulant, just like meth. I mean, you stimulate something excessively, and because the market is young people, you pile on. I mean, certainly one energy drink probably wouldn't kill most people, but if you have three or four or five of them, and particularly in conjunction with alcohol or any other type of stimulant or pre-existing condition that may have been undiagnosed at that point in time, it's a hazard, and it's an unregulated one because they hide behind that this is a naturally occurring product. It's not really a drug, so it's not regulated to the same degree that the FDA regulates pharmaceuticals and other things that are clearly marked as drugs.
So what is the solution here? I mean, what is, from the perspective of you as an attorney, and you don't have any ongoing cases, but like you say, you track this stuff, you develop it, you provide support for other cases, presumably people,
right.
Their attorneys come. What is the end game from the perspective of people who want to protect consumers?
Well, I think what the states and cities have been doing really has resulted in a lot of modification already. I mean, you look at the billions of cans of Red Bull that are sold every year, and they tout that. They brag about it. And they also say that it's safe, that it has unique ingredients. So City of San Francisco, a number of states, Vermont, Oregon, recently just filed litigation against them, saying that, well, if you're going to say this stuff, then you have to come in and prove it. So it's marketing that they focused on, that you're falsely marketing it as safe, and that it'll do all of these things for people in a natural, healthy way. So I think that is one
so
way to do it.
How does the if the corporations face these actions in these states, how do they remedy it? I mean, if they were to say, like, look, okay, you're right, we're not going to make the claim that it's safe anymore. We're just going to go, it's fun, it's super.
Well, you know, and I think that's where private litigation picks up the difference. But I do believe that with the states bringing the attention to it, because the more we hear about something being unsafe, the more it's in the news, that's a positive effect.
Right.
For us as plaintiffs' lawyers, consumer protectors, we believe that the more discussion there is, the better. But the other part of that is suing them for marketing what we contend to be a defective product. It isn't adequately labeled. They aren't appropriately warned that more than one
Is it difficult in the absence of statutory authority because they fall in this gap because it's supposedly natural? There's no sort of statutory, no regulatory sort of regime around these things. Is it more difficult to sort of to require them to put, like, hey, could be dangerous if you drink a
right.
lot of these?
Well, in a sense it is, but we know from doing our other pharmaceutical litigation that the FDA falls so short in its ability to really protect consumers. That's why we have the work we have. That's why we're at Mass Torts Made Perfect. That work is ongoing even with FDA
right.
involvement. So in a sense, yes, but not really, because that's what private litigation does. That's the void that we fill as consumer lawyers, that we figure out our theories, that we look at the deficiencies in warning and labeling, marketing, and we use those as our theories of recovery. You know, and I think we may see less of the negative effects of these products because of the bad publicity, because of the claims that have been filed. But it's a huge industry.
But how does that happen? I mean, honestly, I mean, if we're talking about kids, or in the case of my producer, a guy who's in his mid-20s who just won't even have any of it, he won't hear it, even though we try and tell him every day. I mean, how does that permeate? How does that message get out?
Well, I think what you're talking about is someone who says, I know all of this and I'm doing it anyway,
right.
versus teenagers and adolescents whose parents don't know the harms of it and who themselves don't know the harm of it. So regulation of sales to that vulnerable population. Marketing that they do, holding them legally accountable for it is a way. And, you know, thankfully, if we don't have a terrible outcome, then there may not be a private suit for an individual who's using it. But I know that you've seen, Sam, that the newest trend has been to combine those drinks with alcohol. Mm-hmm. And the FDA has regulated that and said you cannot market that as being safe. That is a hazard.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
And it's because
of
the alcohol being introduced,
right?
That FDA then all of a sudden has authority.
Right. And they're saying that if you're trying to market that it has such a potentially profoundly negative effect on heart function that you cannot ever say that's safe to do that.
Interesting. Virginia Buchanan. I jumped the gun just a little bit because there was more of that interview, and I think we'll probably play the whole interview as we go into the medical negligence part of it on Ring of Fire next week. And on Monday, I may have another interview that I end up playing from here from Linda Lipson. She's the CEO of the American Association for Justice, which is essentially a trial lawyers lobbying. I mean, lobbying may be, let's call it a lobby, essentially, a trial lawyers lobby. Trade association, and we talk about a number of issues, particularly forced arbitration, which is part of the CFPB report. I don't know if we'll end up talking about that, running that on Monday. We may run it on Tuesday, because on Monday I want to probably get into some of the news that has broken out. Reminder that you can support this program. Well, right now, there's multiple ways of supporting this program. We're still, our Indiegogo campaign is still going forward. I have been told by Matt and Mike that this week it's been warmer in Brooklyn, and that we may have to get a portable air conditioner. So that may be part of our stretch goal. I think we have 1 week or so left on the Indiegogo campaign, so you can support the program that way if you want. Also, the best support, of course, is also to become a member. You can become a member at majority.fm. Today is a freebie Friday, but often what we do is, or every other day, you only get 45 minutes. And most Fridays we try, but it just, like, somehow we can't seem to shut up enough to cut the show short. Michael's just wrote to me the number two. I don't know what that refers to. Maybe that means we have 2 weeks left in the Indiegogo campaign. Yes, we have 2 weeks left. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Get it this month, the month of April, free shipping for Just Coffee. So get on that. Of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, we still have our Amazon link at majoritireportkickback.com. I'm going to take some IMs. I don't know if I'm going to be able to take phone calls today because I've got to wrap it up and catch a plane. The International Herald says congrats on the podcast award. Thank you, Harold. Still, the excitement still tingling through me. It was. I think yesterday, I was particularly emotionally invested in this. I'm not sure why. I just sort of felt like we got to win it four times. And there was some big shows. You know, Democracy Now! Was nominated. Dan Carlin's show was nominated. No Agenda, which apparently has been around for a long time. I got to be honest, I never listened to that one. Rachel Maddow's audio podcast was nominated. So we went up against some pretty big shows. Gosh, I don't want to misstate the name. But I met her name... escapes me at the moment. But she was very nice. And her show sounds actually... trying to find get to the podcast awards right now. Her show sounded interesting to me. Apparently what she does, and I'm going to get the name of it. You don't seem... Oh, here we go. Oh, there we go. They have posted the winners at... it is a Congressional Dish. And apparently what the show is she reads congressional bills that have passed and basically just simply explains what they are without, I think, a lot of editorial on it. And I forgive me, I can't remember her name, but it sounds interesting. To be honest with you, I haven't listened to it, but that actually sounds interesting to me. But so that's a long way of saying thanks, Harold. Labia, arsenic in wine and fecal matter in energy drinks will all be cleared up by the invisible hand of the market, right? Another example of the failure of self-regulation. If the profit outweighs the risk, they'll do it. Indeed. You know, that actually captures sort of the real problem. Well, one of the problems with the libertarian ideology is that they presume that if the profit outweighs the risk, that it's okay. In other words, if it's okay for the supplier, then it's okay for the consumer, which is absurd. Which is absurd. Psychedelic. I believe we are the best as a party when we lead with our principles and not according to the polls, O'Malley added. And every election is about the future, and leadership is about making the right decision and the best decision before sometimes it becomes entirely popular. Did O'Malley announce yet? Jay Tingle, WAPO. Brownback was sponsored by his friend in the Senate, Rick Santorum. The ceremony was performed by the Reverend John Mikulski, a member of the controversial and strict Opus Dei sect, who helped convert a number of high-profile people, including columnist Robert Novak, former abortion provider Bernard Nathanson. That's the Opus Dei. Can't believe that a right-wing a-hole like Wynn allows a bunch of liberal lawyers to meet in his hotel. Where does Feinberg fit in? Says Matt in the BK. I'm not sure who Feinberg is. Storky. Liberal TV programming is on the decline because younger generations watch on-demand video. Fox is the most watched network because its older, mostly retired audience watch TV the way they have always have. Indeed. Psychedelic Quaker. I believe we were... Oh. Added the O'Malley thing. There you go. Reagan in the money. Greetings. I'm happy to see you having a good play date with your little friend Jank. Great interviews. In serious news, you liberal perverts are all the same, all sexually attracted to radical Islam. I've seen the websites, Hot for Muhammad, Almighty Backdoor. Okay. What a bunch of creeps. How can someone get off to a bunch of burly dudes chanting death to America? Seriously, please explain yourself, Sam. Effeminate liberals. Oh, my God. According to a right... Oh, this is a great story. Effeminate liberals are sexually attracted to masculine brutality of Islam, according to a right-wing rabbi. Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my God. We got to see if we can get him for a debate. All right, folks, that's all the time for today. I got to catch an airplane. We'll be back Monday. I'll be back Monday. We'll be live. Have a great weekend. And I guess just talk to you soon.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get just got caught between the truth and the lie. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted in and out of-